And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
All right, we are back. This is Chatter on Books. And because Liz Clark was so fabulous last week,
exactly,
we asked her to come back.
Hold over for another
our surprise guest last week.
She's been sleeping in the guest room for the last 6 days.
Well, after seeing your house, yes, I do want
absolutely
to
welcome. This is the official undisclosed location.
Oh, yes.
That's right. With no bartender this evening, so we are all on our own. Oh. But you hear David Aldridge and Jeannie McManus. Michael Kornheiser, God bless him, Coach Kornheiser, is out with the golf team. And so we just have him on TBD.
Exactly.
But yeah, we're gonna move on. So we got some great stuff on tap for this evening. I've got some random thoughts and some emails because yesterday was Agatha Christie's birthday. She would be 129 years old. We're going to talk a little bit about her. And there is an ongoing debate about her and her work, Genius or Fraud. So we'll debate that. We have Liz Clark back, which is fabulous, and I've been getting emails and texts from people who have a lot of questions and a lot of things they want to talk about, because Liz can talk about anything in sports, and we want to talk a lot about a book everyone should read called One Hell of a Ride.
Mm-hmm.
And Liz, Jeannie and I were talking about this before you came. I read it when it came out, and I loved it, and I went back and read it a couple of weeks ago, and I loved it even more. And Deserted Island, because we know there are going to be many, many books about Jeffrey Epstein. Mm-hmm. Everyone has to predict who will write the definitive book about Jeffrey Epstein, and what will it be called?
Okay.
Okay, so think about that. Calvert Woodley went over there today. Michael Sands is deep in putting together the catalog. I have no idea what the catalog is, but you don't find people like Michael during the month of September because they're putting the catalog.
Is
it spectacular?
Amazing. Yes.
So he's in an undisclosed location, cannot be reached.
I don't blame him.
But Jen took care of us today, and we got this lovely West Hill Napa Valley cab. It's very nice. I really like last week's. I'm not even a big red wine drinker, but everybody here liked last week's. Marcellus is nodding his head yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But this is the West Hills of the Napa Valley. They say they have a variety of unique features that make the area renowned within the Napa Valley. You've got that tectonic soil thing going on here. Jeannie, do you like it? Oh, you're doing the white. Liz is doing the red.
You love it?
Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you have any of last week's? I don't think you did. I think you feel guilty that you were.
Yeah.
Okay, there we go.
Last week.
Yeah. So we got that. And
we've loosened you up for this reason.
That's right. And then Ibrahim at the La Chiserie, back from his vacation in Myrtle Beach, which he said went excellently.
Really?
He happened to get a good week of good weather. Yeah. He gave us a Cabot Cheddar private stock aged cheddar from Vermont.
Cheddar was very good.
It's really good. Yeah. My friend Luke is now the economic development head for the city of Burlington, Vermont. So we now care about all things Vermont. I think I'm going to become very crafty supporting my friend Luke in his job.
Is that where Ben and Jerry's is from?
Originally, yes. Yeah. Originally. So and they have a great tour. You don't get as much free ice cream as you would think, but it's a great tour.
The coldest I've ever been in my life was in Burlington, Vermont.
Really? Is that right?
Yeah.
What were you doing?
Sporting event?
Well, I was
curling competition
in Killington, Vermont, and a bunch of us went up to Burlington just to, you know, get educated briefly. But it was a really cold day, and that lake, man, the wind chill from that lake went right through your bones. It was really cold. Anyway, I digress.
Okay, we digress. We have a couple emails. So we have one from Dave Hollick. I can't tell where Dave is from. Thanks for the great podcast. Entertaining, and it breaks me out of the books I normally read. Which is good. We hear that a lot, which is nice. I would have read
X, Y, or Z. And the
books
surprise us how much we like them.
Exactly.
But do you remember last week, Celebrities Reading Classics, and David won? Mm-hmm. With
what
did I do?
Richard Pryor.
Richard Pryor reading Huckleberry.
Huckleberry Finn.
Yes. Yeah.
Totally won.
Yeah.
This is pretty good. Mel Brooks reading the Bible, or at least the Old Testament, considering per Tony what side of the street he's on. That's pretty good.
That's the greatest joke ever.
We have that from Dave. Thank you.
Oh, God.
Then we got one from Ed Salem in Boynton Beach, Florida. I enjoy the podcast. However, I have an annoying problem. That's the email you want to read first thing in the morning. Thank you. You seem to be the only one to speak close to a microphone. Usually I miss at least half of what your guests say because the others either talk too fast or not near the mic. Louder, please.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right.
I speak loudly and too fast, so shame on me. Yeah, I do. Yeah, people always tell me I talk too fast and too much.
You do not.
Which is why increasingly participants on this show are going to be leading segments like Jeannie did last week. So speaking of Jeannie, I do look at the bestseller lists every Sunday just to annoy myself. Goldfinch right up there. movie is getting killed.
Killed. Killed. Killed. Rotten Tomatoes is like,
yeah.
In Europe, too. I mean, like the
yeah.
And I've read a couple of reviews that said a boring book is even more boring as a movie. I didn't find the book boring myself, but it,
you had to hang in there with it.
Did I tell you the Russia House story? The John le Carré book, The Russia House.
Right.
I read through, I forced myself to read through it many years ago, and it was so boring. Oh, my God. It's the only movie, and this was Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer, at the height of her Michelle Pfeifferness, that I got up and
which was pretty
out of.
Pfeiffer.
Wow.
I got up and walked out of. It was so boring and so uninteresting to me. I'm like, why am I going to waste another hour watching this? I don't care what happens.
An hour I won't get back.
Right.
Okay, here's, you guys have to guess. What's number one on the Washington Post paperback bestseller list right now?
I should know this.
Pumping Iron.
You should. Garfield Gets Fat.
No.
Love that book. No, it's really sad. It's the official SAT study guide.
Oh.
For $29.99. Oh, isn't that sad?
Saying, it is.
Especially since school after school after school after school is saying we don't need standardized test scores anymore because they do not prove anything. They don't indicate anything. It's a complete and total scam. And why didn't they realize that when I was trying to get into school?
Why didn't they trust my essays?
My essays were so uplifting. I don't understand why they wanted those scores.
Being the people who read the essays from SATs, the worst job. Okay, back to movies for a second. Brian and I went to see The Hustlers last night.
I want to see that.
It took me.
Let me save you the money.
No way. Really?
And I went in so intending to love it.
Yes.
88 on Rotten Tomatoes. Not bad, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some good reviews. I love J-Lo. I admire J-Lo.
I love J-Lo.
Just thought this will be great. And Brian was a little reluctant, and I threw up the numbers, and I said, look, she's going to be pole dancing, so I get to watch this great movie, with all these great women and this great director, and you get to watch her pole dancing. Well, she only pole dances, or whatever it's called, for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
It was so slow.
Really?
It was so boring. About two-thirds of the way through the movie, I'm not giving any away, a character, and a minor character, dies. And I was envious because I thought, she doesn't have to be here for the rest of the movie. It was so sad. It was terrible. There's a really cute little chihuahua in it, Liz, but that's not worth paying $15.
Well, it was not at the top of my list.
And okay.
And you've just it was, kept it where
it was on the top of my list. Yeah. Cannot wait. And then I can't wait for Downton Abbey. There's no such thing as anything bad to do with Downton Abbey.
Really? I don't know. It really looks so, yeah.
Oh,
it looks stolid, stuffy. Yeah,
it's good. I'll wear some stuffy little outfit and go all by myself then without you guys.
Can I correct something that I said last week? I referred to a play that had Terry Jones in it, and the movie had Meryl Streep in it. The name of that play is Doubt. I called it something else.
Oh, yes, that's the Terry Jones one.
I knew
at the time.
I was giving the wrong name, but
it's one I wish I had seen. She was fantastic from everything I heard.
And the movie with Meryl Streep is also great.
Ah, good for you.
Anyway.
As we were discussing before, not everybody likes to do real corrections, so good for you. Because accuracy is important on this show. Okay, from the sublime to the ridiculous. Agatha Christie, genius or fraud?
Why did you come up with this?
Because I always look at birthdays.
Yeah.
And her birthday was yesterday.
Right.
And she would be 129. So then I thought, oh my God, she's had a few books out. Mm-hmm. Just a few. At least 2 billion a B.
She's the biggest selling author of all time, other than the Bible.
According to her own estate, other than the Bible and Shakespeare.
And Shakespeare.
But she's right up there. If you go to your Google machine, which I do often, lots of people say, well, was she really good or did she just have a shtick, right? These guys have heard this before. My evil former brother-in-law who hated Vivaldi's Four Seasons because he said so many people loved it, it can't be good. So there are some snobs out there like Michael who say so many people loved all these Agatha Christie books, it can't be that good, right? But something like 66 different books, a bunch of short stories. They always write a bunch of short stories.
The longest running play in history.
Still running.
The Mousetrap.
Right.
Yes.
Hands up, who's read Agatha Christie books?
I think I've read one.
I've not read one.
I think I read
not
one.
Not
one. One of
them. See, I think this is fascinating. Marcellus, have you read any Agatha Christie? Not a one.
I think I read one once.
Got to check with the dogs. I don't think they've read the movie.
I've seen some of the movies that were made from her books.
Yes.
And the most notable one, perhaps the only notable one for me, was Witness for the Prosecution, which is a fantastic movie.
Who was in it? Do you remember?
Yes. Tyrone Power.
Uh-huh.
Greta Garbo.
Wow.
Sir Charles Laughton.
Okay.
It It is fantastic. I think Elsa Lanchester is also in it. She is great.
Okay.
When did this movie come out? Because that sounds a lot like The Love Boat when they would put aging out-of-work actors
on the boat. No, it came out in like 1956.
Brett Eklund will be on it.
I'm really aging, dating myself here. It came out in 1956 or in the mid-50s. But it and I believe it's black and white. I mean, I can close my eyes and see a critical scene in that movie that includes, is it Greta Garbo or Marlene Dietrich? Now I'm really blanking.
Kind of the same.
It's Marlene Dietrich.
Okay.
Yeah. I can close my eyes and see this scene when she is in the courtroom and there's a line she has.
Okay.
Okay, maybe we'll go see it.
Go see it.
Better than Hustlers. So she had this. She had an incredible life. Born into a pretty well-off family, she believed her mother was a psychic, and her mother allowed her to believe this. And that some people say that's where she got her interest in paranormal stuff, and that came into her writing. She worked in a hospital in World War One, mm-hmm. and also worked in a pharmacy where they think she learned about poisons and things like that. Mm-hmm. She marries this dashing young pilot or something like that, Archie, who starts to have an affair. And at a certain point, she disappears. She's pretty famous, and she's had some very successful. And she disappears for 10 days.
Right.
Just disappears.
Takes off.
And they're all, everybody's looking for her. Scotland Yard's looking for her. Yeah. They find her checked into a hotel under her husband's lover's last name.
Yes.
Right.
Which is just fabulous, right? Which a lot of people think was a publicity stunt, and I go, good for her. She hated a lot of the film and TV adaptations, evidently, which they often do.
Yeah. Right.
But billions of dollars.
She could surf.
Yes.
She learned how to surf.
Yes.
I read up.
Yeah. Yeah. The Google machine.
And significantly, always to me, as part of her early education, she was homeschooled, which I always think is sort of a flag.
By the psychic.
By the psychic. I mean, her life is a movie, don't you think? I mean, it was fascinating.
Yeah, I think there have probably been BBC specials about her and things like that, and she's won every award.
This was in the 30s. Her husband comes up to her and says, yeah, I fell in love with somebody else. I don't want to be here.
Yeah. But then she married an archaeologist,
right.
And they traveled all the time.
14 years younger than she was.
Yeah, and that's how she learned so much about a lot of these places like Egypt and this and that, because they were traveling and how it came into her stories. Okay, but the question on the table. Good writer, except because she sold a lot of books, is she a really good writer? Jeannie?
Well, I've never read a book, so I can't really say with any certainty. But I can translate this into the
lack of experience has never stopped anyone at this table from commenting
art world,
about something.
Where some of the schlockiest painters in the history of mankind, their paintings, if that's what you can call them, are hanging on the wall of many, many a living room while really talented artists go unnoticed.
Yeah.
So I think that you cannot discount her incredible popularity, that she's definitely speaking to somebody, that she sold 66 books and 14 short story collections, and movie after movie has been successfully made into, you know, from one of her books. So, I mean, she can't be a fraud.
Okay, David?
I think of the great line from the movie JFK when Kevin Costner, who's playing Jim Garrison, says, why is it that if a woman's a prostitute, she has to have bad eyesight? So why is it if Agatha Christie writes simply and writes and doesn't write in florid prose that nobody can understand? Why is that, like, bad? You know, she writes books that lots of people around the world love.
Right. Literally around the world.
Yes, around the world. So, yeah, she's a great writer.
Yeah. You start to read some of these articles about the real devotees, and they talk about how it isn't this great Shakespearean prose, but she so challenged her followers, and that's what they call themselves. Was she leaving a clue there? Something she would say. Was she leaving a clue, or was that a fake? And they got into the actual gymnastics, if you will, of reading her books. I liken it to Law and Order. And partly because I've watched every episode of Law and Order.
I love
Law and Order, SVU, every single one.
I sometimes watch them two or three. Like, I know how this is going to end, but I'm going to watch it again.
But I like that. I like the familiarity of the characters. I like the familiarity of the plot. I know how this is going. It makes me feel very comfortable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's my Law and Order.
I do like suspense things.
Yeah.
I mean, did you ever watch this obscure BBC production called MI5.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
This was great.
Yeah, those are excellent. Okay, we're going to come back to something even more excellent, which is Liz Clark and her book.
Yes.
So we're going to take a break, and we'll come back in a second. Thanks, Marcellus. We're back. We are back with Liz Clark. But before we go to Liz Clark, so we've got a pile of books here. Everybody must take one. Liz, Marcellus, you must take one. Weirdopedia, the ultimate book of surprising, strange, and incredibly bizarre facts about politics by Tim Rowland. And I think we've gotten emails from him before. Tim and Beth Rowland. They sent a very nice note. Jeannie, lovely little artwork on the front. Pretty.
Landscape, yeah.
Yeah. One for Tori, Mark, Jeannie, Michael, David, plus one for whoever you choose. I'm choosing Liz and Marcellus. Take them
home.
Thank you. Love the podcast. Keep up the humor, variety, and insight. Beth and Tim, thank you very much. Wow. And Tim wrote on the box in which he sent them that that's the box in which he gets his Duke's mayo from South Carolina, Jeannie.
Which
this is famous
my
mayo.
Lifeblood.
Okay. What makes it so good?
It's just the best mayonnaise. That's all I know how to say. It's a little creamier. It might be a little sweeter.
You're such a foodie. I would expect you to make your own.
Well, I have done that, but, you know, time.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
There's a BLT waiting, and it needs some mayonnaise. I'm not going to make my own.
Okay, I am so ADD. I made yesterday morning.
Yeah.
Hard-boiled egg sliders. Have you ever even heard of this before?
No.
You take a hard-boiled egg, you cut it in half the long ways. So you flip it open.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And then I took a little guacamole, put the guacamole on there, a little piece of bacon, little piece of cheddar, put your other half of the hard-boiled egg back on, stick a toothpick through it, a little salt and pepper. Food sensation.
Goes down like cream.
How did I get to be this old and not know about a hard-boiled egg slider?
Oh,
really
so
spectacular.
The egg.
The egg is the yeah, the halves of the egg.
Even better.
Yeah, really good. Okay. Now, finally, Liz.
How can I follow that?
Okay, as we said, Liz was so good last week that we asked her to come back. And Liz, we have gotten a lot of emails and texts and tweets from people. We have to do a few of those. But we are such huge fans. And Dave and Jeannie have been talking about this, and we are so glad you're here. And most people know a ton about you. It's literally award-winning journalist. You've covered all the major sports and some of the minor ones, right? You can do basketball. You can do football. You can do NASCAR, obviously. But before we get into your book, One Hell of a Ride, which is really, really remarkable, a little bit of the backstory. Because a lot of people listen to Tony's show. A lot of people listen to this show know you, but some people don't. So a little bit of the backstory. Where you're from, what you wanted to be when you were five, who were your favorite childhood authors? Take us back.
So I'm from a military family.
God bless you.
I always felt a bit rootless, but in a happy way, you know, up for an adventure and like moving and traveling. But both my parents are North Carolinians, deep roots. I mean, sports-wise, they're big ACC.
Where were they
basketball.
From in North Carolina?
It's so hard to explain, but basically the rural Northeast where there's very little, you know, not gorgeous like Duck or Corolla, not the coast, but the rural quadrant. Farming. So my childhood, we moved around every few years, lived the longest time of my childhood in D.C. because my dad managed to get his transfers between Andrews and the Pentagon, and you know, so that at school age, we could, my brother and I could finish school without having to move.
Where'd you go to high school?
Started out at Oxon Hill, at elementary and junior high school, and then I switched to National Cathedral School.
Nice.
Jeannie
just snarled a little bit. Rivals.
I grew up loving theater and really wanted to be an actress. My brother and I were very involved in plays. That was our big passion.
What was the first play you were in?
First play.
Mousetrap by Agatha Christie.
No. There was a very active, like furious, lots of plays from junior high school on, but my sequencing is wrong. I mean, it's a little fouled up. It might have been, I mean, the crowning achievement was Emily in Our Town, I have to say, but
nice.
Who didn't do that? But we did Eugene Ionesco.
Holy cow.
No, we had quite a visionary director. We did some like children's fables. We did The Great Cross Country Race. We did The Diary of Anne Frank. I was Anne Frank.
Wow, nice.
You were Anne Frank.
Oh, of course, yes.
Wow.
So anyway, my passion was theater. And
is that what you thought you were going to do?
No. I mean, It was what I wanted to do, but I kind of had a sense that I wasn't tough enough for total rejection, constant rejection. But that said, that's why I wanted to live in New York. So I chose a college in New York because I wanted to move to Manhattan as fast as I could.
Barnard, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that is how I ended up there. And I kind of quickly realized that I couldn't take the rejection of theater, at least for acting. But my other passion was newspapers as a kid. I mean, from third grade on, we got both of the papers in D.C. when we were growing up, the Star and the Post. But I was always self-conscious about my writing, so painfully self-conscious about my writing, that I majored in history rather than English, because I didn't want to have to read my work aloud and have anyone, like, see it or hear it. After college, when I was trying to figure out what to do, and there was like a period of searching around, is a pretext for still living in New York and enjoying music and, you know, a lot of in search of Bruce Springsteen. That other interesting.
New Jersey is so close to New York.
I just burned, you know, beat the path down there quite often. I came to this conclusion that I didn't want to go to law school, business school, all the things people were doing, women were doing in particular, in that era. That I should pursue something I loved and believed in, which was newspapers.
Nice.
So I had a very late start.
First journalism job?
The Raleigh News and Observer. I mean, the first
Best.
Paid one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a great newspaper. I had some volunteer unpaid internships leading up to that, but my first paid job was the awesome Raleigh News and Observer.
It was a really good paper in its day.
It really was.
And
you covered Sitton. He was just an amazing reporter.
And you covered what?
I covered, well, initially courts, cops, the basics. Mm-hmm. And then
Which comes in handy in sports.
And then I moved to, yes, it does. Then I moved to higher ed, which was a great beat in North Carolina because the politics are very intense. The budget was very intense. And it essentially is what separated North Carolina from the Deep South. You know, the New South versus the Deep South was the university system. And all that Bill Friday had built and Terry Sanford at Duke had represented it. It was quite, again, the reason that North Carolina was more forward-looking, I believe, than a lot of the South. So it was a great beat. And it was through that beat, oddly, that I pivoted to sports because I ended up writing about academic fraud in college sports.
That probably made you really popular in North Carolina.
Yeah. You're so nice. Yeah, exactly. After that, I was offered a chance to go to the Charlotte Observer, which was slightly bigger.
Charlotte Observer is bigger than the Raleigh News and Observer?
At the time. Now, I mean, well, boy, it's a sad time now. They're both owned by the same company now, and they're both still have some great journalists, but they're
that's the herd that you are hearing in the background because they hear Liz's dulcet tones.
Oh, I don't know.
No, she's a dog person.
So I went to Charlotte to cover news issues in sports. Mm-hmm. That was the thought. Specifically, was Charlotte going to get an NFL expansion team? Because they had gotten the NBA Hornets, which was a huge economic coup, prestige coup for Charlotte, which was always trying to get out from under the shadow of Atlanta and state it assert itself as a serious banking and business center. So what I thought that would be like a 3-year, very interesting assignment to cover NFL politics, money, extortion, all the issues that come into who gets an NFL expansion team. And then I would go back to news. But I never went back to news because I really was interested in sports. And there was a great need and appetite for news-oriented stories about sports.
Yeah, but not a jock growing up.
I mean, yes and no. You know, the team sports weren't a big deal. I'm old enough where there really weren't a ton of team sports, but I was very athletic and sporty. I mean, in terms of climbing trees and jumping off roofs and, you know, playing kickball and doing gymnastics, you know, things that you did to stay active. And I was really, you know, a bit, I guess. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what I love to watch, I love to watch the Olympics and I love to watch tennis. But no, I didn't follow major league sports.
Did you play tennis?
I played a lot of tennis, but not in a schooled way.
Yeah.
You know, I would, my friends and I would hit all day long, but I didn't know how to really serve or come to the net or win a point. Yeah. I just wanted the points to go on forever.
So
I had no killer instinct.
I don't know what your fans say to you, but the emails, the texts, the tweets, et cetera, there was a lot of, they divide your world into tennis and NASCAR. And they see those as two very, very different things.
And it's kind of funny.
Pearl the Girl, that's the Twitter handle, can't wait to hear this podcast. Please ask Liz how she became so interested in two sports, NASCAR and tennis, that are so totally different.
Yeah. So with tennis, it just was authentic. Who didn't, growing up in the 70s, love tennis and like want to be either Chris Evert or...
Such great personalities.
Yeah, great. Yeah. And on the men's side, too. I was a huge Borg fan, Nastasi fan. Anyway, so I just truly love tennis. But wasn't passionate about other sports. The NASCAR thing was the most unexpected out of thin air. It was just because I had gone to work at the Charlotte Observer, mm-hmm. and Charlotte, second to Daytona, I mean, it really was the heart of NASCAR in the day. That's where all the teams were based. Mm-hmm. The owners of NASCAR were based in Daytona, but all the teams and the drivers were based in Charlotte, around Charlotte. So the Charlotte Observer was really the paper of record for NASCAR in the 80s, 90s. And I was there for a different reason, to cover the NFL expansion, but it was such a big deal twice a year. Pretty much the whole staff had to cover NASCAR, and I totally remember the first time I was asked to go out to the Charlotte Motor Speedway. I was like, oh my God. You know, I had no idea where it was, what it was. I thought, like, it was dirt. I didn't know it was a paved track. I didn't know it was a mile and a half around. I thought it was just some outback. But anyway, So, had that first or second job been at the Lexington, Louisville paper, mm-hmm. I might have learned to write about horse racing.
Yeah.
You know, it was just the quirk where I mm-hmm. landed. Yeah. In sports, you know, more so than today, they were quite regional. So I was just drafted to cover it. And it's not like I love the sport, but anybody who writes and tells stories, in that time, in the mid-80s, you would be the worst reporter of all time if you didn't find this intoxicating. I mean, it was really like being sent to cover the most epic county fair or state fair. I was an American history major. I always had an interest in the South and the peculiarities of the South, particularly the poverty, the kind of self-made quality of a lot of people who settled in the South without benefit of, you know, education, a lot of mm-hmm. formal education. And I had actually written my senior thesis on chain gangs. I mean, I was just really interested in kind of the dark, forgotten side of the South, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. I'm totally getting off the track.
I'm really interested. You could have written a book about any sport and done a really good job.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is
so
not
what
our show.
Caused you?
Yes. So...
Why write a book about NASCAR?
Yes.
But so, I think you were getting to it, talking about the people involved who are different than other athletes.
Well, they were. Now, this is a NASCAR that is gone now.
Yeah.
Let me just say, it doesn't exist now. And I was around it intensely when it had a foot in both worlds. And after Charlotte, it became my full-time job. I was a full-time racing writer at the Dallas Morning News and at the USA Today. But when I really learned the sport was my time in Charlotte. When I worked in between my NFL beat. So I don't think I ever had the self-confidence to, out of the blue, say I want to write a book or I'm going to get an agent or make a book proposal. But I got unsolicited a phone call maybe after 5 or 6 years working at the Post, at the Washington, no, a decade after working at the Post, from an editor in New York, from Random House, saying, mm-hmm. I've read your work. I really think you're a lovely writer. I'd love to work on a book with you. And I'm thinking, would you be interested in writing a book about either gymnastics or tennis? Because mm-hmm. those are the things she had read that that caught her attention. And I said, I'm overwhelmed. I'd love to write a book. I'm quite afraid of the whole idea, but this is so great. But I have to say, if I were to ever write a book, the thing I am most confident about writing and the thing I really think I have something to offer is to write a NASCAR book, knowing that she would hang up the phone. I'm like, this will kill me. And she said, no, well, I'll listen to that. And so to fill in the blanks, what it was in 2006 or 2007 that I felt I wanted to say.
The herd endorses that.
It was, and I may get weepy, and that is not the goal.
Oh, but
I
have no, that's great.
That I wanted to say about the late Dale Earnhardt, uh-huh. who was killed in the 2001 Daytona 500.
Yeah, right.
And of all the drivers I came to know and the retired drivers and the car owners from, say, I was introduced to the sport in 92. So I had known Dale for about a decade
right.
before he was killed. He was the most, to me, interesting, ornery, difficult to know.
Complex.
He was so good to me. I mean, it was just inexplicable why he decided that he would trust me. He was very helpful to me in his way. And I think this had to do with, for various reasons, he always felt himself an outsider. He had dropped out of school in ninth mm-hmm. grade. He had had a really tough coming up and was quite self-made. You know, got his girlfriend pregnant, worked at a gas station, was married at 17, just worked in the cotton mill. I mean, just dead-end guy at a dead-end life in a dead-end town. Everything was like you're going nowhere. And all he wanted to do was race cars. And his road to racing cars was so hard-fought and hard-earned. And he never, for all the money he made, he never really felt, I think, accepted, you know, mm-hmm. which he used this persona of I'm the badass, I'm the meanie, I'll run you over. He was one of those athletes, and I know, David, you know examples, and Jeannie, you too, where the public image of the athlete is so different from mm-hmm. the true athlete, and that image is often cultivated for deliberate reasons. It's
sure.
often cultivated to make them look better than they are, and they're really just like a self-absorbed meanie. Mm-hmm. He was the opposite. He was like the most loyal, tender-hearted, you know, kind of insecure, a very thoughtful guy who knew that what was going to make him money is the intimidator, badass guy. So his death, which, is at that race,
yeah.
was, you know, apart from the death of my own mother, the hardest,
oh, wow.
the hardest day, the hardest thing to get over, ever.
And to write about.
Ever. And I'm nothing special, because people who followed the sport and followed him at the time, you know, it just destroyed them.
Mm-hmm.
It destroyed them. And it ultimately destroyed the soul of the sport.
It mm-hmm. did. Fans seem to have been. I'm sure it's not the same now, because the drivers have become celebrities, like a lot of mm-hmm. athletes. Mm-hmm. At the time, they were so close to their fans, and their fans felt like they were so close to them. They felt yeah. like they were all in one big family.
Sure.
You have a story early in the book, One Hell of a Ride, sure. which everyone should get. Story early in the book about a fan who had died, and he asked that he be cremated mm-hmm. and his ashes be driven around the track once by Richard Petty, right, and then spread across the field, and they did.
Oh yeah,
the drivers were very low key in their manner,
very humble.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. very humble. And I mean, this has a lot to do with the lack of unions in the South. You know, there's never been a union. There's never been organized labor.
Right.
So deep in the culture of stock car racing is, I can be replaced. You know, mm-hmm. something, I break my collarbone, they're going right. to drag me out. Some guy is going to drive my car. I'll never get back in the car. That's why mm-hmm. Dale included race with a broken collarbone, race with broken bones. This thing was so in their culture that they had no real guarantee.
And racing really did change after he died. A lot of people would say not for the better, right?
They tried to make cars safer. Was that the direct result of his death?
Yes. There had racing deaths come in clusters historically. Mm-hmm. Like in the 60s, there were a lot of deaths by fire that were just gruesome
right.
because they hadn't invented the fuel cell. So any wreck involved gasoline and fire. So that you'll have like a cluster of death and then a safety improvement, and then things go along, there's no death, and then a cluster of deaths. So there had been a cluster of deaths before Dale in the 11 months prior. I want to say 3-4 drivers died, including mm-hmm. the grandson of Richard Petty.
Right.
That should have been a red flag, but these were not NASCAR's meal ticket. You know, it wasn't enough. The threshold mm-hmm. wasn't enough to force NASCAR to do something. So so there were safety improvements made. There was a pressure to do so, and there was a need to do so, and there was. But, you know, some people will tell you that's what killed racing. They made the cars too safe.
Right.
It's like there's no highlight reels anymore. I reject that completely. What killed racing was the death of its soul, you know. Earnhardt was its soul,
mm-hmm.
And then the selling of the soul that remained by really misguided leaders, misguided. Mm-hmm. You know, NASCAR's a family-owned business. It's not.
Right.
Is the Francis family still?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a family-owned business mm-hmm. that has an acronym that makes you think it's not a family-owned business, but it's a family-owned business. And, you know, there's this famous Chinese adage or saying, I'm sure you know it, you know, the first generation builds a business, the second generation makes it successful, the third
right.
generation destroys it. And this is played out through newspaper ownerships, through manufacturing right. yeah. throughout the history of time. And it's kind of, you know, the third generation of NASCAR ran it into the ground or the ditch or in many, many ways.
Do we still have it 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But it's so diminished. It's so diminished or so different. Well, it's both diminished and different.
One of our, Mark Varner sent a tweet and a question for Liz, lifelong race car fan, loved One Hell of a Ride. That's Liz's book. It helped a Minnesota boy better understand NASCAR success. Do you think that the transition from Southern regionality, is that a word?
Mm-hmm.
Southern regionality led to the decline in current track attendance. It was a Southern thing.
It was a Southern thing, just like, you know, RC Colas and Moon Pies and Duke's
yeah.
Mayonnaise.
Duke's Mayonnaise, you right know? Up there, right?
And I mean, as a student of American history, I love regional things.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's music. I mean, we're now seeing the Ken Burns fabulous documentary on country
music.
It's not my taste, but it's a great telling of, you know, Bristol, Tennessee and or Virginia and why country music has the roots it does. So those were my entry points to NASCAR because it was just seemed so uniquely. I wondered, why wasn't this a Southern thing? And that really goes back to Scott's Irish Immigrants. Have you ever read Jim Webb's, the former senator,
yeah.
the secretary? He's a lovely writer.
Yeah. Smart guy.
Super smart guy. His book, Born Fighting, was a great, there's a great thread. In fact, I cite his book. That book many times in my book that explains what the Scots-Irish who came and settled Appalachia brought with them.
Right.
So mm-hmm. there's this tradition of making their own moonshine, of distrusting government, of not paying taxes, of a bartering economy. This is mm-hmm. all related to stock car racing and why it is Southern yeah. and why it came up and what it has to do with moonshine running. So that's kind of the early part of the book and what interests me. So to the reader's smart question, yes, you know, moving away from the regional roots was part of a very complex bunch of factors that spell to me NASCAR's demise. It wasn't simply that the greed that was throughout every aspect of American business in yeah. the 90s.
And lots overbuild. Of sports.
Let's buy five houses. Let's, you know, expand this company in sports. It wasn't just the overreach, like, oh, we've got to have a track in Las Vegas, in Los Angeles. We have to go get all the major media markets. It was that combined with the very naked rejection of its Southern roots. It wasn't just that we want to expand. It's like, yeah, we want to forget that you guys are fans because you're kind of embarrassing and you're not really the demographic that we want to show
right.
as national sponsors. We don't want to be sponsored by Mountain Dew or Skoal chewing tobacco. All the corporate sponsors,
right.
were
yeah.
regional corporate SDB, Motorola. Well, we want to have, you know,
McDonald's.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Pepsi. Yeah. You know,
homogenized. Yeah.
And so there was, and to expand, they had to take races out of the South because there's only so many dates you can have. So all the small Southern tracks, including the one that the fans' ashes were blown into the smithereens, North Wilkesboro, which is one of my favorite tracks, they always had two races a year. So they all got stripped to down to one race.
Right.
So it's kind of like a slow death by paper cuts. You let these little tracks die.
And there's a great scene in your book. You went back to visit. Is it North Wilkesboro, right?
Yeah.
They gave you, they said, lock up after you leave because it was deserted. But now Dale Earnhardt Jr. is trying to get something done with it.
He is. I just saw that on Twitter. Dale Jr. is so, so smart. I mean, it's such a great, so different from his dad. And I say that in an honorific way. He is his own man.
Yeah, which is hard to do.
Always has been. But he is a great student of racing history. He knows a ton about racing history. So, and he's also contemporary and a techno geek.
Yeah.
And he plays all these racing games. So if I've got the story right, he's trying to get one of these many, many iRacing companies to go to North Wilkesboro and do this scan, digital scan of the track so that it could be a track in gaming. But the track, oh my God, I mean, I was there 10 years ago. I shed tears.
Yeah.
There are trees growing up through the landscape.
Oh my God. And there was nothing to take as a souvenir because it's just rubble.
No, it is so.
Yeah. Is there a NASCAR Hall of Fame?
There is.
Is it a good one? Oh, Russ doesn't think so. That's Russ right now.
I mean, it's hard for me to really embrace many of the things NASCAR has done in the last 10 years to try to be relevant again. So they had kind of an NFL style audition. You know, they pitted many cities against one another to host the NASCAR Hall of Fame. And, you know, it was very commercial. It was very crass. It ended up in Charlotte. I've only been once. It's very cool. I mean, if there's a lot of interactive things. You can actually race some of these tracks and get your score and beautiful, you know, historic old cars. It's great. But my sense is it's been, you know, it's not bringing the money to Charlotte, as with so many things.
Right.
But to circle back in totally out of order, as far as why I wanted to write the book, I never completed this thought because I got way too off the track. But to distill,
so to speak,
I felt two things. The main thing, it was really I wanted to say what I knew about who Dale Earnhardt was, because it was quite different from the two-dimensional image, and enough time. I had no stomach to write about him for many years after he died, but you know, there had been like 6 years that passed, and I thought, you know, I still haven't read who I think he was or who I knew him to be.
Uh-huh.
So he's like three chapters maybe out of 11.
But he's present in the whole book. In the whole book.
Yeah, and not that he was the alpha and omega. I mean, certainly Junior Johnson had a lot to say about the alpha. And, you know, they're great pioneers that I enjoy telling their stories. But on a personal note, I really wanted to speak to who I thought he was, what he represented, and what the sport lost losing him. So that was my real personal thing.
Yeah. You know, it's fun. As you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself, right after he died, I was driving up to Pittsburgh to see my folks, 2001, right? February of 2001, right?
Yes.
And so I'm driving up to see my folks, and I've driven it 10,000 times, so I always try back roads and this and that, whatever. And so I'm driving through, you know, northern Maryland, southwestern PA, right? These kinds of places.
Sure.
And everywhere there were tributes to him.
Sure.
So his reach and his power really did go beyond.
Well, it was profound. And I mean, I remember so vividly, you don't want all my vivid memories, but it was clear at that point working at the Washington Post that the editors who run the paper, who are super, super smart people, always have been, always will be, this was a bit of a blind spot for them. I mean, understandably.
Yes. Yeah.
Kind of I mean, I think for many papers, maybe the death of Selena, which had preceded that. It was like, oh my God, a whole section of our country is grieving. Mm-hmm. They're inconsolable about the death of an artist or an athlete. We really, who wasn't on our radar? Mm-hmm. Who can you tell us who this person was and why? Why does it matter? And that was a great honor.
And that's it's. I think
it was very sad.
But we may have, I may have said this last week, and I say this too often, but Hillbilly Elegy was read by way too many people, and too many people ascribed too much significance to it because they were trying to figure out what's going on in this country. Mm-hmm. If you want to figure out what's going on in this country and what a lot of people are thinking and feeling and doing, read One Hell of a Ride. I really mean that. That talks about a lot of people in this country that, with all due respect, the people on the East Coast and the people on the West Coast and the really smart people who work at newspapers and everywhere else in business just don't get it. They just don't get it. And speaking of just don't get it, David, you've never been to NASCAR. You're about to go to NASCAR. Mm-hmm. Liz, what advice do you have for him?
Oh, well, we've talked some, but it's so different now in 2019 than it was.
We'll fake it. You can fake it for him.
And, you know, I mean... I told him, I mean, first of all, he's chosen the perfect track in my
Richmond,
which has a foot in the past, a foot in the present. It's 3/4 of a mile around, which, I mean, you don't want to go, all the new tracks are a mile and a half. They're all cookie cutter. They all race. It's like, it is if the entire PGA Tour was played at the same golf course over and over and over, it would not be very interesting. So golf geeks appreciate the different tracks, the different courses. So Richmond, to me, has the greatest racing because it's close quarters, small enough. There's a lot of contact, but it's not contact that makes your, you know, where you really worry about death. It starts at dusk, it ends at night, so the lights come up. I mean, it's just...
How many people in the stands?
Oh, from the high water mark of 95,000, it's probably going to be about 40,000. Uh-huh. That's how I'm guessing. But I would just say, as David and any great journalist would do, is go with open eyes and ears and just realize it's going to assault you in the best possible way. I mean, it is so loud. You feel a vibration through your esophagus. Was it, it's just so great.
Was it Richard Petty in the foreword? By the way, Richard Petty wrote the foreword to this book, which is remarkable. No, it was
George Bush like endorsing her book, but that's okay.
Yeah. Okay, George Bush moment. Bush 41, 92, ill-fated Bush Quail campaign. One of the few bright spots in that entire year, because there were none, was we went to the Daytona 500. And Bush 41 was so ecstatic because the drivers let him come down to the pits or whatever it's called.
Oh, yes.
Is that what it's called?
Yes.
They let him come down to the pits because they liked him. And he was a guy, right? And they liked him, which he thought was great. And then at some point later, I guess Clinton tried to go and they wouldn't have anything to do with him. And it was seriously one of the few bright spots. One of the very, very few.
Well, I mean, my sense is the political divides and rancor that you might find in a NASCAR garage or the partisanship. It wasn't so evident, you know, 10 years ago. I totally get what you're saying because I also have a memory of Clinton coming to Darlington and a lot of drivers like were not interested.
Don't need that.
I was shocked. I mean, that was at that time, it was shocking. Like, how could you not? Our divisions weren't as venomous and over.
Yeah. But something Jeannie and I talked about before you got here. We've seen it in everything you cover. Athletes, people let you in a way that most people don't. And this is a particularly unique community of NASCAR, and they let you in and they trusted you, which was an exceptional thing. And I think that's what makes One Hell of a Ride such a great book. There clearly people, I felt like I was there. I felt like I was at the track. I felt like I was sitting next to Richard Petty. I felt like I was there listening to these stories.
Well, you know, I think there's a little bit of this in NHL players. I mean, you can somewhat generalize about athletes in different sports. Race car drivers in general, and certainly NASCAR drivers back in the day, they are wide open. I mean, it's like, you want to know what a restrictor plate is? Come on over here. I'll open the hood. Like, this is what it is.
Right.
This is what it does. You want to sit in the car? Sit in the car. You want to drive the pace car? Drive the pace car. You know, I mean, it's just completely wide open. Interview me as I'm going, as I'm strapping in, as mm-hmm. I'm saying goodbye to my wife. And, you know, yeah. there's not all this faux cone of silence. I'm going to put.
Right. I speak only have, on yeah. Tuesdays.
Yes, yes, it is. No, no, no. It is just like anybody who shows up, does their job,
right.
asks a lot of
come
questions.
Along.
Or actually, I think the one of the reasons I got off on a good foot with Earnhardt, which was not my agenda, it's just I didn't talk a lot. I mean, I
you listened.
I watched and I listened. And when
yelled
I didn't
that's huge.
Understand something, I would
yell at you.
He did. I mean, so the first time I did a long story with him, it involved spending a whole day with him, like starting at 6 a.m. at his home, at his garage. Yeah. And then we got in the truck, his truck. We drove to North Wilkesboro, did all this stuff. And I followed him throughout the day. Dale Jr., I think, was like 16 then.
Yeah. Not being quite as responsible as his dad might have wanted him
no.
to.
I could tell it was getting under Dale's skin. I was just watching him and like writing in the notebook. And he was like, aren't you going to ask me something?
Okay. Everyone should read this book. One Hell of a Ride. How NASCAR
sure.
Swept the Nation. Whether you love NASCAR or not, it's a fabulous book. Liz, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Come back with Deserted Island. I'm going to let the dogs run down the street because that'll be less noisy. And we'll come back. Thanks, guys. So we're back. It's Chatter on Books. We've had just the most amazing, wonderful conversation with Liz Clark. Thank you for coming back twice. Just so spectacular.
Oh.
Everyone should get One Hell of a Ride. It's really, really, really good. Okay, so we know there are already books out about Jeffrey Epstein. There will be many, many, many more books about Jeffrey Epstein.
Yes.
And TV shows and movies and everything else. If you were an actor, would you play Jeffrey Epstein in the movie?
Ooh, sure. Ugh. Give it a year.
Oh, man. Be a lot of millions of dollars. So what's the, who should write the definitive work about Jeffrey Epstein and what should it be called? Jeannie, would you like to go first?
Well,
if you can speak over Russ. That's Russ the Corky. I just want to identify the criminal.
Oh, I feel like I should just bring Russ down and put him right next to me.
Okay.
Well, I just finished reading She Said by Jody Cantor
right.
and Megan Twohey of the New York Times about the whole
good Harvey for you. You're so current.
Epstein.
Little reader.
Well, it is a really, really well done book. I would say the first 75% of it I liked more than the last 25% because then they kind of veer off. They've dispensed with Harvey and they veer off to Christine Blasey Ford and just the whole sort of Me Too movement. And it's interesting, but it's not as interesting as the story they tell about the stonewalling that they were up against.
As reporters?
As reporters. Yes. Which, so that's just my personal interest, which maybe a lot of readers won't have. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly been the same kind of stonewalling about Jeffrey Epstein, mostly because of his incredibly influential companions.
Yes.
You know, Bill Clinton, notably, Dershowitz. Yeah.
Others whose names we'll soon learn.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
And so I kind of thought, well, this book cannot be reported by one or two people. It has to actually be a coalition. And I would get Jody Cantor and Megan Twohey to focus on the women. They were very, very good about getting these fragile, vulnerable women to finally go on record or even off record, but to give them enough information that they could begin to write. I mean, the first story that they wrote was such a lightning rod, and other people then began to surface
sure.
and talk, and more came out. So I would start with them, and I would start this coalition with the obvious person, Julie Brown, the Miami Herald reporter. Mm-hmm. That's her name, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Gotta believe she's working on the contract.
She has been way out in front of this and should certainly deserve to have a book out of it. And she understands the whole Florida connection and all of the negligence of those prosecutors and DAs who just, you know, let Jeffrey Epstein, you know, roller skate in and out of jail every day. But then I think you need somebody with, and the New York Times reporters have this too, but somebody with incredible political clout to knock down the doors about all of these colleagues of Epstein's who were on the private plane, who were going to the island, who were going here, who were going there. And I would enlist in this coalition. Now I've got, what, four people, three people. Okay. I would enlist Bob Woodward to come in and do a deep dive.
Wow.
Yeah. To get...
Because he works so well with others. I'm sure he'd be thrilled to be part of
Well, I know. This is a dream team, okay, that I've come up with.
But the intent is appropriate.
But because you really need somebody who can find out about Dershowitz, about Clinton,
right,
about other notables who were... Donald Trump, who were rubbing elbows...
And other body parts, clearly.
Jeffrey Epstein.
Nice angle.
So that's my dream team for the book.
Like that, David?
Well, I'm at a loss because, first of all, the person that I want to write this book is no longer alive.
So. That's okay. Aspirational.
McGinnis.
Good one. Wow. Really good one.
Wrote Fatal Vision, wrote all these books about these powerful men who did these monstrous things and thought they had gotten away with it. But didn't, because somebody like Joe McGinnis was like, well, wait a minute, what about that? But he's gone now. So, but you're exactly right. I think you need someone who can step up to these powerful interests. I would not go with Bob because I wouldn't go with Bob. I'll just leave it at that. But I would go with Carl Bernstein. I think Carl would be very good at getting people, at getting into those worlds. He wrote a very fair, sympathetic biography of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Somewhat sympathetic, I should say. And I think he could get these people to kind of fess up about their relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And well, I would call it Under the Bar.
Under the... Oh, I like that. Good. Mm-hmm. Like that. Did you have a title, Jeannie?
Oh, no. Let me work on that.
Okay, work on that.
Next week, I'll bring my title.
Liz, I didn't give you this homework, but do you have any thoughts?
I didn't, but I'm feeling so inferior because I'm dazzled by both of your visions. I mean, off the cuff, I'm picturing Ronan Farrow.
That's mine. Good one. Yeah. You're brilliant. Oh, you're brilliant. Really
Maybe teaming with David Fahrenholt.
Okay. Excellent.
And we definitely would want some outstanding female journalists. I mean, I worship Carol Lennig's work.
Yes.
Although, you know, she doesn't work so much in this terrain. She could do anything.
She's great.
I can't. I mean, Jeannie cornered the market with the dream team.
Yeah.
So I bow down to that combo. And I've never been good with headlines or titles of any sort.
That's why you have editors.
So the only thing that comes to mind is me. It is like the antithesis of Me Too.
Mm-hmm. I'm totally with you on Ronan Farrow. I just think he is remarkable. There were so many things stacked against him in all the work he's done over the last several years, and he continues to do good work. But I think you improved that idea. And I would call it blind eyes. Ooh. The many people who let Jeffrey Epstein do what he did. Because he clearly was a very, very sick puppy. And I'm not forgiving him or absolving him or anything. But clearly a sick person. And I honestly don't know how much control he had over what he did, right? And his perversions. And they clearly were perversions. But there were many people around him who enabled his perversions.
And his perversions seemingly took very little pains to cover his tracks.
Right.
Well, and facilitated.
They facilitated and enabled and encouraged and allowed. And that they're the ones that really horrify me. That's excellent. Okay, on that cheerful note.
Well, I have a business question.
Go for it.
So if Jeannie could assemble her dream team, what would the advance for that book be worth?
Wow.
Oh, millions. Millions.
Well, because, well, Woodward,
just take 10%, Jeannie.
Yeah.
Millions. Yeah. Oh, that'd be good. Then who does the movie? Who plays him? If there is a movie, who plays Jeffrey Epstein?
An unknown. It would have to be an unknown.
I would give Steve Carell a shot. He's been very good at playing very different.
Did you ever see him play the crazy DuPont?
Yeah, he was good in that.
He's fabulous in that.
He was good in that.
Very, almost, I mean, it was still him, but it wasn't him. The movie about Bobby Riggs and Billy
Jean. Yes. Davis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually pulled that off, which I thought he would.
Yeah, and willing to do it.
It wasn't like a total lampoon.
No.
I mean, it
made him almost sympathetic. He wasn't, but he was almost sympathetic.
Oh, there were sympathetic parts to it.
Much better actor than I ever gave him credit for.
Yeah. Good guy. Liz Clark, this has been fabulous. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
All right, a little housekeeping. Please listen. Please download us. Please review us kindly, as they say. Marcellus, thank you for being here, doing all the important work. We couldn't do it without you. Jeannie and David, thank you for being here. Michael, we hope the team did well, because we think you've got a golf match this evening, or whatever we call it. And if you come back next week, we're going to have Ed Aymar, A-Y-M-A-R, fabulous guy, writes crime, writes these dark, serious things. He has some really interesting stuff going on in D.C., and we will have him next week. And Liz, because she's going to move in here, because she's the sister I always wanted. Thanks, you guys. See you next week.